This is Jackie Feldman. I'm here with Margaret Flowing Johnson. Could you please say and spell your full name, first, last, and nicknames for me?
Margaret, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, Catherine, K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. My family nickname was Midge, M-I-D-G-E, and my taken name is Flowing, F-L-W-I-N-G.
Okay, thank you. Today is October 31st, 2017. We are in St. Louis, Missouri. Flowing, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Thank you, and thank you for participating. So to start off, could you tell me a little bit about where you're from?
Well, I was born and raised in Des Moines, Iowa, and I was there through high school. My father was in the military. I was born in 1940. My father was in the military before World War II started, and during World War II, he was overseas the whole time. My mother was born in Des Moines also. She had polio as a child, and so she was handicapped all of her life. And in 1958, when I was graduating from high school, my father retired from the Army and we moved to Joplin, Missouri, which is where most of my family lives now. And then I came to St. Louis to teach in 1964, and I've been here ever since.
Thank you. So could you tell me a little bit about your experience of moving to St. Louis and that transition?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you.
Oh, sorry. Could you tell me a little bit about the experience of moving to St. Louis and the transition into
New City? I got my degree, my master's degree in mathematics from Kansas State College at Pittsburgh, Kansas, which is used to be called a normal school. It basically trained teachers and agriculturalists. And when I got my bachelor's degree, they asked me to stay on as a teacher assistant. I got my master's degree, and then they hired me on as a faculty member. So I was there, and I began to realize that I was always just going to be, one of their students, that I was there. And so I had a friend in St. Louis, and when I came to St. Louis, her mother, who was a math teacher at a junior college in Florissant, told me that the community college was starting, St. Louis Community College was starting. And I was up here over Christmas holidays, and I went and got interviewed during the break between Christmas and New Year's, and the president hired me on the spot. So I moved to St. Louis in 1964, and it was one of the best moves I've ever made. It was just an incredibly creative place to be. Because I was hired during the second semester of classes on a temporary campus, temporary buildings on the campus at Merrimack. So it was just wonderful. It was a great transition. Moving to a big city, that's where I discovered I was a lesbian and got away from my family and got away from the very insular faculty that I was with at Kansas State College. So it was just a great move for me. It took me a while to get oriented, because when I first got here, I didn't realize I was a lesbian, and I was isolated most of the time. And when I realized I was a lesbian, everything changed. It was great.
So could you tell me a little bit about that process of realizing?
Well, I had been a Girl Scout counselor at the Girl Scout camp in Joplin, and when I moved here, I had a roommate who was a woman who got her master's degree at the same time as I had, and we were roommates for like a year. And then she left St. Louis, and I was rooming by myself. And then one of my friends, who was a Girl Scout counselor in Joplin with me, decided to come up here to teach. She was a Girl Scout professional in Joplin. And she quit being a professional. I didn't know why at the time, but she did because she realized she was a lesbian. And she didn't want to run the risk of contaminating the Girl Scout Council in Joplin. So she came up here, and we decided to room together, and so we roomed together, and she kind of fell in love with me, and I decided to try it. So that's kind of how it happened. My father also died in that same period, so I was very emotionally disturbed at that time by his death, and stuff was very unexpected. So we got very close during that time because she was so much support to me and stuff. So that was when I realized I was a lesbian. I was 28 at the time. Because, you know, back then I kind of knew about lesbians. I don't know, but I don't think I really understood about lesbians at all. And when I look back on my college career, I spent a lot of time hanging out with lesbians, but they were so in the closet, they never said anything to me about it, and I didn't realize what was going on. So it was just a terrible time to figure that out, because when my first partner and I realized we were lesbians, we tried to do some research on lesbianism, and all we could find was all this stuff about it being a mental disease, and you know, it was, and the only book we could find was The Well of Loneliness, which was like a terrible book. So it was a difficult time to figure that out. But we came out into a really nice community in St. Louis that was mostly couples, both gay men and lesbians, who at the time called themselves gay women. And most of the social activities we had were in people's basements. So most of the couples had bought houses kind of in suburbia, and they had a rec room in the basement, and that's where we had most of our social events, were in people's homes back then, at the, you know, until I caught feminism and got involved with a more radical political lesbian community, and then everything changed again.
So what changed when you got involved with the more radical community?
Well, what changed for me is I caught feminism. I began to understand about the oppression of women. I began to understand about racism. In fact, I had a pretty big fight with my first partner, because we hung out with a lot of couples, gay couples, that at the time the gay community was extremely racist. They were all white. They were very racist. They were very misogynist. Their humor was all based on insulting women and insulting people other than white men. And I finally told her, I can't be with this group anymore, because I'm just mad all the time. So, and then I went to my first women's concert, Meg Christian, in the women's building at Warshoe. I'll never forget it, 81 women. I'll even remember the number, put on by Red Tomato Productions. And it just changed my life, because I suddenly, here were all these lesbians, and I'd never, didn't even know this community existed. They were the more politically active lesbians, and so it just changed my whole social outlook, and I began to get active in that with those women. And my partner and I ended up splitting up over it, because she never adjusted to being a feminist or not at all political and that kind of stuff. So we just split up. It was happening. That was during the time when lots of women were leaving partners. Straight women were leaving husbands, and lesbians were leaving partners. And it was during a real awakening during that second wave of the feminist movement in the early days. And so it happened everywhere, including the lesbian community.
So what was that new community you found like?
Well, it was very boisterous. It was in the streets a lot. We created the first Women Take Back the Night March in St. Louis. Lesbian community was very involved in creating rape crisis lines and the Women's Self-Help Center. We were escorting at Reproductive Health Services, which is what became Planned Parenthood here in St. Louis. We were just very, very active in all kinds of stuff, active in the labor movement. That was when the NRA was being pushed. There's just lots of stuff going on. We had women bookstores, we had women coffee houses, we had a women's newspaper called Moonstorm. There were like women's dances a lot, at least one dance a month, if not more. And they were held in church basements. There were a lot of lesbian bars at the time. Of course, the bar scene in St. Louis was still pretty seriously involved with the criminal element in St. Louis, and East St. Louis particularly. And they were raided a lot and stuff like that back then. So, but the dances in church basements were awesome, because they'd be maybe 100, 150 of us, and you'd be down there just sweating and dancing and carrying on and looking at this group of women, most of whom at that time you knew, and it just was just such a wonderful feeling of community and home, and you know, it discussing or being lesbian to that point had been taboo. So it was just amazing to find that community of women of all different ages and races, mostly white, but because St. Louis was so segregated then, but there would be, you know, a fairly large number of African-American women and Asian women that had come to the dances, but they had their own places to party and stuff, so.
So were those dances the main way you met other lesbians, or were there other community spaces that also?
Well, no, I met most other lesbians I met through political organizing. You know, you'd get involved in organizing something like the Take Back the Night March, or organizing with a self-help center, or working on Moonstorm, or helping out with the bookstore, because all those things were pretty much run by volunteer labor, and that's how I met my lesbian friends, was mostly through organizing, which is kind of still the case.
Do you have any memories of specific people from that time that really stand out to you?
Some specific people?
Yeah, like individuals that were important in your life.
Well, when we planned the first Take Back the Night March, which was a huge success, that was in like 79, we had over 1,000 women come. It was women only. And we rented a stage and stuff, and we started out in Forest Park, and then came up out of Forest Park. At that time, there was a road that came out of Forest Park onto and crossed King's Highway and went down Euclid. So we came up the park and went down Euclid carrying candles and stuff. And when the concert I mentioned, Meg Christian talked about Take Back the Night, and she has a song called Fight Back, which is about taking back the night. And so, and she talked about the marches that were happening around the country. So I got real excited about it and started talking about it. And somebody said that the woman who ran the newly created women's studies program at UMSL was talking about the same thing. I'd never met her. So I called her on the phone, and I was teaching at Merrimack Community College. She was a teacher there. So we kind of used our privilege as academics to help get the thing started and get the kind of traction that we needed to get to be able to start raising the money to get the speakers and that kind of stuff. And so I met her, and then we started organizing it, and we organized it. There were about 30 women involved in organizing it, and we met every Saturday for months and months and months to plan it. So, and I'm trying to remember her name, Nancy something. She ended up moving to Providence and opening a bookstore. So that was one of the women I met during those kind of early days in being a lesbian activist in St. Louis. But Chris Kleindienst, who is one of the co-owners of Left Bank, was very involved, still is very involved. Rudy Nickens, who ran a gay African-American gay man who ran Sunshine Inn, we had lots of meetings at his restaurant. He was closed, technically closed on Monday nights, and so on Mondays, so Monday evenings were prime time for activists to have meetings at his place, and he always fed us. And so there was just a really broad network of activists in St. Louis that were doing all kinds of stuff back then. It's still true, obviously. Focus is different now, of course, but it's the same things happening now with the current movement in St. Louis.
So could you tell me more about some of the activist groups you've been involved in?
Well, a lot of things that I was involved in were one-offs or two-offs, so they didn't stay around long. But two organizations that I was involved in that stayed around for a while, one was Women Rising in Resistance. Women back then was a euphemism for lesbians. And it was a small group of women. There was a Women Rising Resistance actually started in Champaign, Urbana by a woman named Mary Lee Sargent, who was a teacher at a community college there. And she started it the state of Illinois would approve the Equal Rights Amendment, it would be law. And so she started that group to try and use civil disobedience to push the the legislature in Illinois to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. They did a lot of civil disobedience and stuff. And she was a friend of mine. I met her at Michigan, so at the Michigan Women's Music Festival. So we talked about making Women Rising Resistance be a network thing, kind of like ACT UP, in terms of how it would have chapters all around the country and they would be, you know, pretty autonomous. So we decided to start one in St. Louis. And so I had her come here to do a workshop at WRSU on a Saturday morning about women rising resistance and direct action and that kind of stuff. And that morning, and one of the women came with an article about a guy who had raped a niece of his over a period of years, and was finally, the niece told the mother about it. He was arrested, he was charged, he was tried, he was convicted, and the judge gave him probation. And the reason why the judge gave him probation is because he'd had the same job for 10 years. So, and we didn't know at the time it was a black-on-black crime. So it infuriated us. And so we decided to do an action about it. Right there on that spot, we started Women Rising Resistance. And of course, there were a lot of women at that workshop. And I don't know, maybe 30. But it was also a weekend with a lot of bar activity, and there was a lesbian dance that weekend. There was a lot of stuff happening on Saturday. So we right away decided to go to the judge's house and do an action at his home. The judge's name was Judge Care. And so we went and we leafleted all these different activities. And that Sunday night we had over 100 women there. And we did a lot of press releases and stuff, but basically no press came. But everybody was really shocked that we were there. But we got some coverage from the Post-Dispatch. And to our shock, the Post-Dispatch publicized our next meeting, which was also at WRSU. And so when we had the next meeting, the place was mobbed with people. A lot of African Americans in the audience, because they knew that this crime had, they knew about more about this crime than we did, because we just knew what we read in the Post-Dispatch. And that kind of launched us on a trajectory that lasted for, I guess, about a year and a half. And we mostly worked on issues of violence against women. There were, as there still are, lots of women being murdered by partners in town, and the restraining order system wasn't very good. And we discovered that when a woman tried to get a restraining order against her husband or her partner or whoever, if she lived in the city, she'd have to go to the city courts to get a restraining order. But if she worked in the county, she'd have to go to the county to get a restraining. It was just a complete mess. And then we're talking about a lot of times poor women that have to use mass transit. So we got enough traction with the actions we were doing that we got the city and the county to work together to figure out a way to have women get restraining orders without having to run all over town to get them. And this particular group lasted about a year and a half, and then the Hardwick decision happened, which is the decision about sodomy that happened in Texas, and it was a Supreme Court decision. And I was coming home from somewhere, I don't remember where, and heard it on the radio. That the Supreme Court had made, it was a Friday night, of course, heard it on the radio that the Supreme Court had made this decision about Hardwick, and I didn't even know they'd heard the case. And that says something about where the lesbian and gay movement and community was back then, that a case that was about the criminalization of same-sex sex, I didn't even know they'd heard the case. And I was so furious when I got home, Marcia and I were partners at that time, that I ranted and raved, and we decided to contact our to start our phone tree to get an action about this, and I contacted Jim Thomas, who was the editor of the Gay News Telegraph, and he activated the male community, and the next night on Saturday night we had an action at the old courthouse about comparing this decision to the decision that was in the Dred Scott decision about saying it was okay for people to own people if they were African American, and this decision about sex between same-sex couples. And then all hell broke loose with Women Rising Resistance because we used consensus as a decision making process, and we hadn't taken the time to go through the consensus process because I was just so furious. It was a mistake for sure, but we changed the name of the sponsoring organization to Lesbians Rising Resistance for the purpose of the action. But when the press came to the action, they said, "Who are you trying to kid? We know who you are." And they used Women Rising Resistance in the newspaper. So there were women in the group that were in the closet for various reasons, and they were so furious that they might be associated with an action about lesbian rights that basically the decision that we made was that, well, okay, so you decide the next time what decision to make and call the group together, and well, you know, you decide what action you want to do next. And we were basically getting our actions from the newspapers and from stuff like that, and we never had another action. So that broke that group up. And then the second group I helped form, which I helped form with my partner Marsha Levin, and a bisexual man, John Cohen, was St. Louis Queer Nation, and it lasted for a long time, several years. We did a lot of actions. We were very active around the Cracker Barrel actions. That was a national movement. We did a Stop the Church action, which had like over 100 people on Easter Sunday at the cathedral on Lindell. And the three prongs of that action were reproductive rights, homosexuality, and AIDS, the church's attitude towards homosexuals, women, and AIDS. And so we had, it was a three-pronged action. It was a very exciting action. We planned it for maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 months. And we had a citywide planning group do it. So it was, and we hung around for a long time, and we finally just kind of decided that we'd done our duty, and we were beginning to get a lot of traction, and people were coming out of the closet, and so the need for visibility actions for lesbians and gay people seemed to be lessened at that point. So we stopped the organization at that point.
So how did you and Marsha meet?
We met at one of the actions. We met at the Judge Care action, the first action I spoke about. She was working in Victim Services Council in St. Louis County, and then she came to one of the planning meetings, and we fell in love, and we've been together ever since, 32 years now. So that's how I met her, in action. And we still are in the streets together periodically.
So you mentioned bars and dances as a place that you spread the word about some of these actions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view the role of like things like bars and dances in your experience of St. Louis? How do you view? I can hear myself really loud. How do you view the role of bar spaces like bars and dances? Just in your experience.
Well, in my experience, I never was much for bars. I did go to bars sometimes. I did a lot of dancing on the east side, and so we went to dances. My first partner and I went to dances on the east side a lot. There was a bar over there that was owned by a lesbian who was a fantastic singer. She'd been a singer at, and hopefully I remember her name, she'd been a singer at Lake of the Ozarks, and I don't think she exactly opened the bar in East St. Louis, but she started doing shows there, a couple of shows a night, and we went there a lot to hear her sing, and then we would dance there. We always went with a group of people. And but I never was too interested in bars themselves. And then a woman named Mac, I can't think of her last name, Mac. Anyway, she owned several bars. She owned a bar called Bottom of the Pot. She owned the bar called More or Less. And the Bottom of the Pot was below. There was a gay bar. This was on Euclid Street. A male bar called Potpourri. and the lesbian bar was in the basement, so I called the bottom of the pot. And they were, at that point, there were a lot of lesbian and gay clubs on Euclid until the city wiped them out and very intentionally moved them out of there during gentrification. But the bar called more or less was on Newstead, just north of Manchester, kind of where the Grove is now. And it was a very small bar in what at the time was a pretty run-down part of town. And we did, we started doing a lot of organizing out of there. We had a back room where we had meetings a lot. And at one point she wanted to buy a piano. And there was this purple upright piano she wanted to buy, and she wanted money for it. So a bunch of us got together and did a gong show. You know what a gong show is? A gong show is where you have really bad talent come out, and if they're really bad, they get the gong and they have to leave. And so we decided to do a talent show, and we called it the gong show, and I did a striptease in it. And I practiced to do this thing, and wore a wig and makeup and the whole thing. And a lot of people came to the show because they heard that Midge was going to do a striptease. And the funny thing about it is when I came out, they didn't recognize me. So we raised money for her to buy the piano. So that's the only bar that I really had a relationship with. And she was open for several years. And then she moved to a place on South Grand. This was when I was starting to travel. She moved to a place on South Grand, and the place got firebombed. And they arrested her for it, but of course they never convicted her because she didn't do it. She said she didn't do it. I believed her. She moved her bar to a neighborhood that didn't want a lesbian bar, and they burned it down. So, but I'm not much of a bar fan. Coffee houses are more my speed. And like I said, in the early days, it was people's basements. And during the height of that lesbian feminist movement in St. Louis, there were lots and lots of house parties. There were lots of lesbian houses in town that had various names. They would have a party. There would usually be at least one party in one of the lesbian houses at least once a month that you would go to, and there'd be maybe 50 or 60 women there partying. So it's good.
Was it ever challenging for lesbians to own homes?
To own homes?
Yeah, or to be able to rent or buy a house.
Well, yeah, when I, my first partner and I, we decided to own a home, and we had a lot of trouble getting a loan. We went to several mortgage brokers, and we actually bought some land in the country and wanted to build a home, actually. And we finally went to one guy, and I can't remember even what bank it was now. This has been so long ago. We went in and we're being interviewed by the banker, and he says, "Well, I'll tell you what, you remind me of my daughter. She's a teacher." We were both teachers. "She's a teacher. I'll give you a loan." It was like, yeah, right, okay. But it was just really difficult to get a loan if you were a woman. Difficult to get lots of things done if you're a woman. We decided since we were going to be living isolated in the country, we needed a weapon. So we decided to buy a shotgun. And a shotgun that would hold three shells, and so we keep the shells, but they weren't in the firing chamber and stuff. So we figured out where we wanted to get and stuff, and we couldn't buy it in St. Louis County because we had to have the permission of either a husband or a father to buy a weapon. So we went out to Jefferson County and bought it with no trouble. So it's just all those weird stuff that women had trouble doing back then. I taught at Merrimack Community College, and I was there when I realized I was a lesbian, and I remember I was elected faculty president, and I remember standing, giving my first speech to the faculty and stuff, and I'm thinking, I wish I could just tell you that I'm a lesbian. Of course, I didn't. And then later, I was asked to run for president of the union, and I went to the people wanting me to run, and I said, you know, I don't know if this is ever going to come up, but I am a lesbian. And they said, oh, well, everybody knows that. I said, well, good. So, and then when I quit my job, I got a full professorship and quit my job and traveled for a couple of years and came back as a very radical lesbian, a very out lesbian at that point. There was no way I could be in the closet anymore. And I had a hard time getting another job. I got a part-time job very easily, but I had trouble getting hired back on full-time. And I heard through the grapevine at Forest Park Community College, where I was trying to get hired on, that the problem wasn't that I was a lesbian. It's a problem that I was being on TV about it. That's during the height of Queer Nation. So that was when I was having trouble getting hired back on. And my students would sometimes say, I saw you on TV, and then they would get really embarrassed. They were very cute about it.
So what are some other ways that not wanting to be closeted and wanting to be out has shaped different experiences for you?
Well, the thing about being out is that you're always coming out, because the assumption, of course, is it's not as big an assumption as it used to be, but the assumption is that everybody's straight. So every time you meet somebody new, and I don't just automatically say, hi, I'm Margaret, I'm a lesbian. I don't do that. But anytime there's something comes up that it makes sense for me to say that I'm a lesbian, I will do it. I take courses at Lifelong Learning Institute, and often something will come up in a discussion in one of the classes that the fact that I'm a lesbian informs some information I have that may be different than the information everybody else in the class has. And so I'll preface it by saying, well, first of all, you need to know I'm a lesbian, and then second of all, whatever the topic was, I'll talk about. But it's no longer, people are no longer surprised. I'm 77, so a lot of women my age never really knew a lesbian until recently. Or, well, they didn't know they knew a lesbian until recently, I suppose I should say. And a lot of lesbians my age are still in the closet. So, and the reality of that is that the chances are pretty good that they're, and a lot of them, of course, were married and have children and have grandchildren and have great-grandchildren now. Because back then, most everybody got married, whether they were lesbians or not, or they didn't know they were lesbians. Like, I didn't know I was a lesbian until I was in my late 20s. So, but these days, their great-grandkids are going to know they're lesbians if they have a partner. So it's just sad to me that there are still people my age in the closet, and I know they are. And, of course, a lot of them are in nursing homes, and that's why they're in the closet, because they don't want to, or retirement homes or something, and they just don't know how they would be dealt with by the people around them if they knew that they were lesbian or gay. So it's old habits. Hard to break.
So you talked about this a little, but do you have any other ideas of like reasons why you think people around your age might still want to stay in the closet?
Well, part of it's habit. A part of it is internalized homophobia. Some people have been ashamed of being a lesbian or a gay man all their life, and that's really hard to shuck that. They haven't found a community, some of them, they don't feel safe. I went to there's a group called OLOG, Old Lesbians Organized for Change. They're a national organization, and the national organization is pretty radical, really, but the local chapter's not. And I went to a couple of meetings, and I never went back because it was just so boring. But I went to one of them, and they were having a, they were kind